Hi, everybody. Welcome to part four, the last in my Favorites of 09 series of podcasts featuring the Gamers Confab. In this episode, I'm joined by Matthew Gallant, who writes the Quixotic Engineer blog, and who earlier this year released a game called Norwegian Wood, which I'll link to in my show notes. You should definitely try that out. I'm also happy to welcome two new members to the Confab, Alex Raymond from The Border House, which is a terrific new blog written by a collection of writers that I hope you'll check out. Alex also maintains her own blog called While Not Finished. And Dennis Farr, who writes for Gay Gamer and his own blog, Vorpal Bunny Ranch. And Dennis also contributes to The Border House. So many thanks to all three guests for joining me. I hope you'll check out the previous episodes in this series. They're all available on my website and also via iTunes. I'll pop in at the end with a few thoughts and with my favorite game of 09. In the meantime, thanks for listening, and away we go. I am delighted to welcome Alex Raymond and Dennis Farr and Matthew Gallant to the podcast. Happy to have you aboard, all three. Welcome. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you.
Welcome.
It's freezing here. It's like it was 4 degrees when I came to my office. It's like miserably cold here. Matt, you're probably the coldest, though.
Yeah, I'm not sure. 4 degrees Fahrenheit or Celsius?
Yeah, we do Fahrenheit. I don't do the Celsius conversion very well. I need to learn.
Yeah. I don't do it the other way very well. It's about minus five here, Celsius.
Okay.
It's so reasonably warm, actually, for this time of year.
Yeah, yeah. Well, welcome all three. I'm very happy to have you, and especially a special welcome to Dennis and Alex, who are first-time visitors to the Gamers Confab, and I really appreciate you being willing to do this with me.
Thanks.
So, since Matt, you are the grizzled veteran of the trio, why don't we launch our favorites of 09 with you? Tell us about your favorite game of 2009.
All right. Well, I would start this off with the disclaimer that there's still a lot of excellent games from 2009 that I haven't played. I mean, people, including yourself, have been kind of raving about Uncharted 2, haven't had a chance to check it out. Been very much looking forward to Brutal Legend, just haven't had a chance to play it. So kind of the games I have had a chance to play, I'm going to pick the extremely mainstream pick and lose all my indie cred and say Modern Warfare 2 was probably my favorite game thus far.
Now, I'm interested to hear you talk about this, obviously, but when you say that, are you thinking of it, is the experience that you've enjoyed most been primarily a multiplayer experience, single player, or both?
Unfortunately, yes, I'm one of those, the Generation Y kids you talked about in your blog that mostly plays it for the multiplayer. I did play through the campaign, and it was okay. I thought it compared poorly to Call of Duty 4, the first one. You know, Call of Duty 4 kind of took me by surprise just how good it was. I really wasn't expecting much. I was expecting another kind of war game. You know, I played the previous entries in the series. They were great World War II simulators, I suppose. They gave you the experience of landing in D-Day, you know, Market Garden. But, you know, I didn't think of them much beyond that. And the first Call of Duty 4, if you can say that, really surprised me with just how great the level design was and how great the set pieces were. And, you know, it was a very authored experience as a shooter. There wasn't a lot of freedom, but they had these great moments. For instance, the Gillies in the Mist level, where
right,
you were,
right,
you know, crawling through Pripyat and, you know, following Captain McMillan and sniping the people. I thought that was extremely well done. They also had a lot of, I mean, it's a bit of a spoiler, but situations where the character you were playing actually died in kind of a spectacular fashion a couple of times. And I thought those were extremely well done. Surprising, so I hadn't seen that done in a lot of other games. And I guess my experience with the campaign in the second one was that they saw how well those kind of set pieces had worked and just did them over and over and over again.
Yeah.
You had several missions where you were following someone and sniping and being stealthy, like the Gillies in the Mist mission.
Yeah.
You had several situations where your character you were playing died at just kind of, I think by the end there are 4 or 5 times that happens. I saw a lot of repetition from the first one.
Yeah. Now I want to explore the multiplayer side of it with you, but one of the things about the first game that struck me as different from the second, four versus the newest one, with single player, and I don't know if you feel the same way, it felt like the single player experience sort of like you kind of discovered that it was more meaningful than you expected it would be. That there were some uncomfortable moments that sort of made you examine what was happening and examine your choices in ways that you sort of wish more games would do, especially war games. But the second game seemed to be sort of more deliberately trying to send you messages that had been calculated, you know, to be delivered in a certain way. And in an odd way, it was less effective for it.
I completely agree. I think the most kind of chilling moment of the first Call of Duty, as kind of Mitch Carpata explained in the Slate Zane end of your gaming club, it was really, really chilling to be in the AC-130 plane. You were kind of a bomber looking down on ground troops and helping them out. And so you had this completely sterile, you know, white noise pilot environment. The screen in front of you was all washed out, black and white, night vision kind of thing. And you were basically bombing people. And it was chilling because it was so sterile. This kind of very precise military operation, this incredibly efficient way of killing people. And if you look at the AC-130 footage from the actual military, it's shocking how similar they are. Yeah. So that was, you know, there was no one in the game telling you, you know, oh my gosh, look at how horrible this is, or, you know, look how unpleasant this is. But you really felt it. Whereas, as you said, the second one really tried to be, you know, set up these moments that were shocking and very obviously intentionally so. No Russian being one of them, the kind of invasion of the American homeland being another one. I mean, these were clearly moments that were very much set up to bring an emotional reaction in people. And yeah, I think that it was weaker as a result. It felt a little more manipulated.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So what is it then about the multiplayer game that sort of steps it up? I've heard most people seem to think that it's an improved iteration on 4.
Yeah, I'm not sure if the intention with the first one, I don't think anyone knew it would be as popular or successful as it would be. Maybe they did. I don't know the marketing or the development behind it, but I think the formula that was kind of stumbled upon in the first one of, you know, having this meta game where you're continuously getting experience for different challenges, continuously unlocking new weapons, and it really does give you the, you know, kind of the one more turn situation from strategy games, or the one more level from an RPG. Gives you a long-term incentive to keep playing, and you always have these kind of long-term goals in the back of your head of, oh, if I use this weapon, then I can unlock this attachment for it, or if I use this perk, I can, you know, and do this thing with it, I can get the upgraded version. I mean, it's very transparent in that kind of, you know, Skinnerian reward system where you're always, you know, just, you know, a little bit more, but it makes it an incredibly compelling experience that I very much enjoy. I mean, I don't think the Call of Duty Modern Warfare 2 just basically manages to add a lot of content without kind of bogging down the system or making it really, you know, redundant. They actually added a lot of content and still managed to kind of streamline it so that it's just a incredible experience.
Do you play with people you know, or do you just match up?
I do both. I don't actually have a headset for my PS3, so even when I do play with people, I don't actually get to talk to them. But we often, you know, talk after, like, oh man, did you see that kill? You know,
yeah.
Dang.
Do you play it on the PS3 for a reason? Is that your preferred platform?
Oh, it was just some friends of mine were getting on that one.
Gotcha. I'm curious. I don't know the answer to this, and I don't know if Alex or Dennis have a take on this, but I mean, the differences between the two communities, the PS3 online community and the Xbox 360 community. I know I've spoken to a couple of my students who played it on a 360 and had the typical kinds of experiences you can have there, with, you know, really awful people making life miserable for them, or, you know, a lot of issues with racial slurs and just mean-spiritedness in all kinds of manifestations. I've always been curious, and I'm not a real multiplayer guy, I guess, with these kind of games, whether the PS3 community is significantly different than that.
I would say absolutely not. I mean, it's just this kind of vile, racist, homophobic statements everywhere you go. There's really not escaping it. Yeah. The best solution, really, if you enter any multiplayer lobby, just mute everyone. It makes the game a lot better.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, I know that Alex, Brinstar, and I do that when we play Uncharted 2. Mm-hmm. I automatically mute everyone who isn't a friend.
Yeah. And if you don't do that, I mean, what's your experience? Obviously, you do that for a reason. Is it purely to avoid this kind of crap that comes flying at you?
Yeah, I remember one time we were playing with a pickup group in Uncharted 2, and there was one guy who was just constant stream of shit talk. Like, and it was like he wasn't breathing. He was just constantly, and it would not stop him. And I didn't even remember until like almost the end of the match that I could mute him. I was like, oh, I just remember that earlier. It was ridiculous.
Yeah, I don't know this game multiplayer, so you guys might know more. But my students tell me that Call of Duty is the worst. That it if you play Team Fortress, if you play, I guess Halo used to be, but now I guess Call of Duty has taken over as sort of the place for the jerks to gather, or the worst of the jerks, or you're more likely to find them there than with other games. Is that just because it's a war game that it does it attract people who, I don't know, get off on being sort of violent jerks, or is that like a ridiculous connection to make?
I think it's a numbers game. You just have so many people playing that naturally you're going to have that percentage of people who are just abysmal. I'm fortunate that my roommate plays it, but he always mutes people as well. And I mean, he generally doesn't care as much, but it even bugs him.
Yeah.
I think it's important to point out too, I mean, that's kind of the downside of going online is you get all these jerks. Fortunately, you can mute them. And I mean, once you do mute an entire enemy team or your own team, and you just kind of have, you know, yourself. I think it adds a lot of value to actually be playing against other humans, especially in a kind of shooter situation. Call of Duty has a lot of, I wouldn't say systems, but I guess mechanics for, you know, camouflage and playing stealthily and doing a lot of things that I think the artificial intelligence just can't support. You couldn't do that with a bot. That it's a lot of fun to play against people.
Is that what brings you back? I mean, is that ultimately, aside from the map designs and things like that, is that what keeps you playing a multiplayer game? Is just the persistent challenge, that the sort of the variability of that with humans?
I would say more the challenge of playing against humans is the short term enjoyment. The long term enjoyment comes from, in a lot of these multiplayer games nowadays, this kind of meta game that happens. In Team Fortress 2, it's often, you know, they have achievements, they have hats you can get dropped, they have new weapons. In Call of Duty, it's, you know, this experience system that you're, you know, always advancing, always getting new things. I think that's going to be the trend going forward of multiplayer shooters. It's not going to be enough to just, you know, have matchmaking and have your experience and your achievements end when the match ends. I think there's going to be a lot more games going forward that try to persist that game to game, long term, and give you something to keep playing for.
One thing that I'm curious about in terms of design with these games, that this kind of trickle flow of maps that keep adding content and keep sort of changing things up or giving you new challenges.
I actually think from a kind of, you know, game support perspective, maps are the kind of the very least you can do to give additional content to players. I think if, you know, Team Fortress 2 has shown anything, is that there's a lot you can do to support a game after it's been released to get the community interested beyond just including maps. They had the great, you know, soldier versus demo man event in Team Fortress 2 recently that was just a great way to get people back into the game. And I mean, if Twitter people are in any indication, lots of people went back to check out the game as a result of that event, much more, I think, than any, you know, bozo map pack would bring people back for.
Are you still playing Team Fortress 2?
A little bit, yeah. I've been mostly playing Call of Duty over the winter, but yeah, the new content is nice. I checked out the new maps. The the new stuff they added for the soldier is really interesting. The boots they added towards the end that support rocket jumping and keeping a little bit more of your health.
Yeah,
it's a fantastic game, and it's the kind of thing that I'm sure I'll be playing for years, but just not so much in the recent past.
Yeah. I have to say, I'm not surprised at your choice, because when I log on to play, I've spent a lot of time on Demon's Souls, and I would say at least half the time that I logged on to play Demon's Souls, I saw Matt Gallant playing Call of Duty Modern Warfare in my friends list. You were very busy with that game.
It was funny. Actually, last week or so, I was much more busy playing Demon's Souls.
Ah, yes.
That's a fantastic game. I'm sure you've already, I haven't had a chance to listen to the first podcast yet, but I'm sure you and Chris tore it up on that one.
Yeah, we did. And I just finished editing. I'm going to put the second episode up just as soon as we're done talking. There's one other person that chooses it, so.
Oh, really? Well, I'll throw out that my number three pick, I suppose, would have been Xenoclash. I hope someone's talking about that, but probably not.
Well, we'll see. This is the last one, so unless Dennis or Alex has something to say about Xenoclash. But we have written about it. Right?
I've never even heard of that.
Well, oh, no. There you go.
I've heard of it. I just haven't had time to get to it yet.
But you should definitely check it out. I mean, we won't go on and on because, you know, it's not the subject here, but it's well worth a look. Partly because, don't you agree, Matt, it's the world that it renders is, I can't think of a game world that's like it, anything like
yeah.
that.
Yeah, not only is kind of the world extremely unique in every aspect, I mean, you have this, I think the aesthetic they were going for was the Cenozoic era, just kind of, you know, after the dinosaurs, you know, early mammals kind of thing, that mixed with just... Yeah, I wouldn't even know how to describe it. I think the what the creators have used is punk fantasy.
Yeah.
But yeah, just unparalleled. And I mean, from a first-time studio and with a, you know, with this great first-person brawler built into it and with this kind of very interesting storyline that, you know, I think you said on your blog, you know, doesn't explore really right or wrong so much. It's very... even-handed and subtle in that regard. It's not kind of black and white.
Yeah, it will not pin down morality. It will not pin down gender. It will not pin down the sort of standard things that you're supposed to draw black and white lines around. The character who's sort of at the center of it all is this kind of unigendered mother-father figure. Father-mother, I can't remember. Is it called father-mother or mother-father? I can't remember.
But I think it's father-mother.
Father-mother, right? And so it's a group of Chilean developers who are really... digging deep into a kind of mythic culture that games haven't, that I can think of anyway, treated in any kind of meaningful ways. It's well worth a look. But it's also, as you say, with all that said, it's a brawler. So,
yeah. A first person brawler, though, yeah. which is rare, and it was very well executed, I thought. And I thought some people had some frustrations with it, yeah. But
it's visceral, though. I mean, ooh, it's just the feeling of getting punched. It's like, oh, it just seems to like jolt into your system. To me, it did anyway. It feels brutal.
Well, it's not brutal in the way that, you know, I think Condemned had first-person brawling, and that was very, you know, you had a lot of physics to being hit. You know, being hit felt like you were actually getting hit, but at the same time, it was very cartoony, which was certainly wasn't violent in the visuals, at least.
Yeah. Well, we'll just toss out Xenoclash and mention that in passing, and we'll move on. Alex, would you like to take the ball next?
Okay, well, I didn't get a chance to play a whole lot of games from this year because I was catching up on some Xbox games that I hadn't played yet because I just got an Xbox this year. But I think by far my favorite game from this year was Uncharted 2.
Ah, yes, yes. So tell me why. What is it about this game that sticks with you?
Well, there's two things. One is the technical achievement that it is, and not just in the graphics, which is really pretty, obviously, but just in a game from a game design perspective, it's really streamlined. And every minute, there's something new happening and something interesting going on that always just keeps the experience moving relentlessly. The other aspect is the writing and the characters, which I really loved and I thought were really well done. And set a new bar for characterization.
How does the game distinguish itself in that way? Because I agree completely. It feels like a significant step forward in terms of the presentation of character, but also just in terms of like the quality of the writing and the dialogue and the storytelling. Were there moments in that game that you sort of remember, or that, you know, when did you know this game was a cut above in those ways?
Probably just in like the first level, especially like in the museum where we have Drake traveling with Harry through the museum, and they had this banter going the whole time, and it's really funny, and they're helping each other through the gameplay also. So they're like both taking out guys to get through the area, and it's clear that they have this like camaraderie going on.
Yeah. One of the conversations that's been going on this year has been this question of authored games versus games that, you know, your experience sort of emerges out of gameplay. And this feels like a very authored game. Mm-hmm. Clearly that's for you. You don't have an issue with that. That's one of the strengths of a game, I take it, from your perspective.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think there's definitely room, like both types of game design are awesome and really great when they're well done. And I don't think one is necessarily better than the other. So, like, I think that Uncharted 2 is basically the best so far of that authored experience, where you get these really great moments, and it's scripted, but it's still interactive, and you really feel part of the experience.
And you've played it multiplayer as well. Dennis and you both have played it. That seems to me to have gotten significantly less attention than the single player.
Right.
I mean, everybody's written about the single player.
Mm-hmm.
I take it you enjoy the multiplayer. You think it's solid?
Yeah, I play a lot of the co-op with Dennis and Regina. And it's just really fun. I mean, it's different than a lot of online shooters in that you can climb around and things like that. So you can go like up on platforms and shoot down on people. And so it's a bit unique in that sense. But I guess there's not much really to say about it, except that it's fun.
I found it to be harder than I expected it would be.
Yeah.
I kind of like got my lunch handed to me the first like two or three times I tried in a big way. I don't know. It just on its default level felt
pretty especially
tough.
In survival, especially which I play a lot, is you really have to strategize with like the different, because they have the different enemy types, zones with the shields that you have to either throw a grenade or like keep shooting at them. Then you have the big guys with the huge guns that you have to get headshots and stuff. So
yeah,
it's really tough.
I played a little bit of the beta for the Uncharted 2 multiplayer, and I thought it was surprisingly strong, especially given it's very difficult to make an online third person shooter if history is any regard. One thing that I especially liked about it is compared to Gears of War Online, I don't know if you've ever played that, but it's the strategies that people use online in Gears of War are extremely different than the ones that are effective in the campaign. You know, people are always running around and rolling right into people's faces, and it's a very different experience. What I thought was neat about Uncharted is that the strategies that work in the single player, at least from the first one that I played, you know, taking cover, you know, popping out and taking a couple shots, moving forward, those are the same strategies that seem to be rather effective in the multiplayer. So they've, and as Alex said, you know, there's a lot of the platforming and the, you know, jumping onto high places baked into the multiplayer. So they were very faithful to the first person experience, single player experience in the multiplayer, which was neat.
Yeah, that's definitely true.
So Alex, I'll apologize before asking this because I hate asking these kinds of questions. You're the only woman we have in the group, and you're in the position of speaking for all women. So please forgive me to begin with. But you know, one of the things about this game that others have spoken about, it certainly struck me, is the presentation of the women characters in the game, significantly more interesting than previous games have been. Do you see it that way?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things I love about the game is how it has such great female characters, and they stay alive. They don't get killed off. So, oh man, there's no refrigeration going on here. Yeah. But
Saved.
Yeah. Yeah.
Generally, yeah. I mean, except for the end, but that was okay. But Regina wrote this great post for the Border House about how the the female characters were so good. They were like, they did things. They, you know, were important to the story. They weren't just there as eye candy or to be with Nate. And they didn't, there was no cat fighting between the two of them. And oh man, there's just so much. And it's really a direct result of having a woman as the lead writer, Amy Hennig.
She, you know, one of the things I found differentiates this game from others is that I always have a problem with what the game wants me to believe about romantic relationships, that you create a male character that is so stereotypically X, Y, or Z, or a female character that's X, Y, or Z, and I'm supposed to believe that they're attracted to each other and that there's some possibility of some meaningful romance there, when really it's just a story hinge for me to, you know, get from point A to B. Mm-hmm. In this game, I can totally see why Chloe is interested in Drake, and I can totally see why Elena is interested in him, and they're for different reasons. And I can see why he's interested in each of them, and why for different reasons. That they're strong enough and well fleshed out enough characters that I'm not just sort of smirking to myself at how ridiculous this quote unquote romantic relationship is supposed to be. I actually buy it.
Right. And I think that's a really good improvement on the first game, because the first game, it did seem kind of like you can tell they were trying to go for romantic tension between Elena and Drake, and it wasn't quite there. It wasn't quite believable.
Yeah.
And they had the restraint to not have them kiss at the end.
I'm sorry, Matt, what'd you say?
Sorry. At least the first game, I thought it was good. You know, that they, as Alex said, they did not set up a lot of believable romantic tension between the two characters, but they didn't kiss at the end or anything. They never kind of followed through on it.
That's true.
Which I thought was very, you know, restrained of them.
Yeah, they sort of left it for the time in between the two games for the player to infer, like, what happened there.
I mentioned this briefly in one of the previous segments, but the moment when Chloe and Elena meet
so funny.
Isn't that a great scene? That is a scene that 99% of all video games would completely screw up.
Mm-hmm.
They would go totally cheap with it or totally stupid with it or whatever. And that is just such, and it's understated, it's smartly written, well performed.
Mm-hmm. And it says so much about all three characters.
Oh God, yeah. Totally. That's the best thing about it. It says you learn something important about all three of them in that moment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. God, I love that stuff.
Well, and it stays sustained. I remember laughing when in the middle of Shambhala, when both Elena and Chloe are starting to make fun of Drake.
Yes.
At his expense.
That was so good.
Yeah. Dennis, you may have a take on this, obviously, with your performance background, but one of the little things about that game that struck me as sort of pivotal is that the facial animations are good enough that the actors are actually assisted by them rather than restricted by them. That there are times when, like, the little furrow of the brow is actually animated sufficiently for me to sort of see her looking at him and doubting what he's saying as he's saying it. And that's actually something you would expect from good actors, but you rarely get it in video games.
Right. And I mean, it's so difficult, especially in games, because most of them, trying to circumvent that, go the opposite route, which is explaining that they doubt it, which doesn't quite work as well.
Yeah.
The lack of subtlety just jars the experience.
Yeah. Well, what about you, Dennis? What's your favorite game of 2009?
It amuses me because I sat there thinking about it, and then I realized there was really only one option, especially because I'm part of a Google Wave for this game, and one of our members of the Wave, Kate, known as Kateri, started compiling links for the game, and I noticed that I had like 8 links. So my game would be Dragon Age Origins.
Yes.
That's a close second for me.
and it's odd because I sat there thinking about it, and I started picking apart the game and realizing I didn't find the mechanics all that interesting. The combat grew repetitive. The overall arching plot was kind of silly and Tolkien-esque and boring. But what grabbed me about the game was the companions and the fact that it didn't have an alignment system. I wasn't restricted to a good versus evil moral code. Everything that I did, all my actions in the game, were restricted to how I was reacting to my companions. And they were well enough scripted that I actually cared about that. And Alex and I briefly mentioned this on Twitter last night, was the fact that none of the characters are 100% lined up enough that having them in your group, you can't please everyone, and you will manage to disappoint someone at all times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This may sound like a silly question, but I mean it seriously. How do you role-play a role-playing game?
It's something I've been meaning to explore further. I have a set of stock characters, and I know how these characters react. It's almost Comedia-esque, except I don't purely make it comedy, and that they all have their certain personalities. They have stock responses to certain situations, just because games throw them at them a lot. So whenever I play these games, I create these characters, and I play it like that. For instance, I really love Alistair, but the first character I played loathed him, so I couldn't get much banter with him. In fact, I managed to borderline make him hate me so that I couldn't advance the dialogue anymore, which disappointed me, but I knew that the character didn't really care about him.
Hmm. Did he leave the party?
Yes, he left the party later on.
So this means then that you take multiple playthroughs to sort of fully round out this role-playing experience.
Yes. At this point, I see games as a big rehearsal process, which for an actor, I feel the rehearsal process, both rehearsal and performance are fun in their own extent, but the rehearsal process is when you're iterating and trying things and experimenting. And having the ability to have multiple playthroughs means you can go out on a limb and just say, I'm going for this. I'm going to stick with this extreme, or I'm going to go with this way just because I know I'll be back. I know I can try it again.
Mm. So the game functions as a kind of malleable playwright then in a certain way for you. Do I see it properly that you're basically playing with a malleable text and in a kind of rehearsal-like way, making different choices within it with characters that you have?
Oh, yes. And I mean, what's great about this game, which I can't say for a lot of other create your own character and then interact with the world type games, that it has a good supporting cast. The characters will respond to you very decently. The whole companion rating system makes it so that they will respond to you and give you different dialogue options, and they'll actually respond to actions you take in the game. I wrote about the fact that this character I knew would have made two decisions that he didn't make in this game because the characters were there to respond to him and tell him, you know, this is kind of shitty. I don't appreciate you doing this.
Mm. How does this game, how to ask this a better way? This is a BioWare game. Does that mean anything to you? What's the BioWare signature? How have they either kept or altered the signature from previous games with this one in your
view?
Well,
and here's the thing. The last BioWare game I actually played was Baldur's Gate 1, because by then I had entered the end of high school, and then I was at Wabash, so I had no time for deep RPGs. So I just stayed away from them, and I didn't get back into them until this one. Another big reason why I enjoyed this game was so much is because of the community surrounding it. Mm-hmm. It was a game my mother hyped. It was a game that Kate hyped. It was a game that I could talk with these people about it. And beyond that, it was a game where I could discuss it with various groups. I'm not going to lie in saying that another portion of it is it was the first sustained long-term gay relationship in a game that I hadn't scripted entirely by myself.
Right. Right.
Which meant a lot, especially since, and Alex wrote about this, it doesn't follow the commodity of sex model. The point of the relationship isn't to get the sex and then that's the end of the relationship. The relationship continues after the sex. It's very mature in that regard.
Right. Characters aren't vending machines.
Right.
It's really awesome how they subverted pretty much every aspect of the commodity model, like down to apparently Kate just told me this yesterday, that apparently if you ask Morgan to have sex, then it's random. It depends on like what her mood is and whether she'll say yes or no. And mm-hmm. like even down to that little detail, like, oh, that's so great.
Alex, you've written about Mass Effect, and I know you have a sense of BioWare as a developer from that game as well. Do you see this game as a kind of a continuing of that tradition, or is it a do you see it as a step forward from what Mass Effect did?
As far as the relationships go, yeah, it's a huge step forward. As Dennis said, the sex isn't the end point. It's just a natural part of the relationship, which is really realistic. Yeah, there's just more there too, because it's a longer game. There's a lot more content, and that gives them room to just explore the characters a whole lot more.
Yeah. So, is it fair for us to presume that something of this development experience will find its way into Mass Effect 2?
I hope so.
I didn't love Mass Effect the first game. I mean, I sort of admired it in some ways, but it just strikes me that having played Dragon Age, but not as thoroughly as you did, and also being aware of Mass Effect, that it you sort of put all that together, and if they're all working together and talking to each other, Mass Effect 2 ought to be incredible if they get it right.
Right, yeah.
Well, and right after Dragon Age, I played Knights of the Old Republic. And what's interesting to me is somebody, he goes by Stillgray on Twitter and writes for Hellforge, made a chart looking at how BioWare tends to use the whole monomyth way of progressing a story. And it seems like they're iterating that and getting better and better at representing that in the game.
Which is tough because, you know, once you've built a model or a template that's sort of formulaically, that it works, you have to break that to do something else. And I mean, from a development point of view, breaking things is not what you typically want to do, right? I mean, it takes guts in a certain way to sort of say, we've been really successful with this formula, we have to break it.
And yet they seem to be doing it rather well. I mean, Mass Effect was, let's break from Star Wars and start doing our own thing. And the first one, you can still see where the Star Wars influence comes in. But looking at trailers for the second one, I hope to be pleasantly surprised that it takes a step further. Dragon Age would be there, same with Dungeons & Dragons. And I imagine there will be sequels, and I imagine they'll go further into stepping away, hopefully, from both Dungeons & Dragons and their reliance on Tolkien.
Personally, I had very little interest in this game until I had read all these great blog posts kind of explain, you know, I'd seen the previews and it was, oh, another fantasy RPG. It's not really my kind of thing, but then it seems to have a lot of depth to it and a lot of really interesting situations that haven't been done before or explored in kind of different gray morality kind of ways. It sounds like a great game. So if anything, you've convinced me to give it a shot.
I wasn't interested in Dragon Age at all either. I was like, oh, 100-hour fantasy RPG, that sounds so exhausting. Why would I want to do that? But then, like, just listening to Dennis and Kate talk about how awesome the characters are, I was like, okay, I have to give it a shot. And I'm really pleasantly surprised. Like, it's really great.
Well, I think one of the proofs that that blogs aren't just stupid waste of time that a lot of people think they are is that sort of shout out to the Border House here, but that it's particularly interesting to me to watch a set of writers sort of surround a game and sort of like get at this and that and sort of pick away at, from their perspectives, what they think is interesting or what they think is problematic mm-hmm. about a game. And that really Dragon Age has received that treatment. People have written about it more carefully and taken their time. Dennis, you're obviously one that's done this a lot, have, you know, really kind of dug into it and in a kind of granular way. So it's not just a set of kind of generalities about the game is good or the game is bad, but I'm going to go inside the game. I'm going to play it and invest myself as a certain character. And then I'm going to write about that experience, which seems to me to be the proof that this conversation is worth having, is important to have.
I was just going to say that I definitely prefer that approach, especially for big games like Dragon Age. It's more like, I think it's more valuable than just like a review or something. So I think it's just more interesting and it's fun to have that conversation.
Yeah.
Well, and especially since even though I love the game, there is a lot to critique. And mm-hmm. I feel that the way critics differ from reviewers, especially in a game like this, is BioWare has been paying attention to its fan base, so writing about these things and bringing their attention to areas where they lack, such as they have all sorts of racial tensions in the game, and then ignore things like, if I create a black character, my family's white. bringing their attention to things like that, I think helps everyone.
Yeah,
definitely.
I like too, Dennis, that in a lot of your posts, you kind of, you weren't just saying, oh, there is great storytelling. You were kind of saying, here is a great story that happened. And, you know, here's how I reacted to it. Here's how it could have gone differently. I really enjoyed reading your perspective on these specific situations. And I think, you know, as a secondhand experience, it was very convincing, and you really showed how this was an experience worth having.
Well, I think it calls to question the utility of reviews when it comes to games like Dragon Age, you know, these 90-hour, 100-hour deep immersive role-playing games, that the degree of usefulness that they have seems to me to be significantly limited when you approach it as we do almost all games, which is a reviewer has the game, gets an advanced copy, spends, just like dives into it, you know, day and night, plays it like crazy, and gets a deadline met by writing a piece about it. That does not take into account the kind of community involvement and the ways that you're kind of, the conversation about a game over a long period of time can alter one's perceptions. And sort of multiple playthroughs, like Dennis did, multiple perspectives, that your sort of standard issue GameSpot review is just not going to get anywhere near that stuff.
Well, particularly since this game is so large that each of the origins and each decision you make in terms of your race and to some extent sex alters the gameplay, alters it, how you will see the game and how people will react to you.
Well, I hope that people who haven't played it, I mean, I've written about it, and my issues with the game are mostly about the kind of conventional RPG aspects of it. Mm-hmm. I know that's probably a quibbly way of thinking about a game that has a lot of deeper stuff going for it. You know, maybe I need to dive back into it and just kind of let go of that and see what happens to me. Or maybe I'll just wait for Mass Effect 2. So I don't know. We'll see.
It's coming soon.
Well, thank you very much. Those are three games that we'll strongly encourage people to check out. And I really appreciate your accounts of your experiences with them. I mentioned before we started recording that I would ask you to give me a little heads up on a game for 2010 that has your attention, if there is one, so before we wrap up. So I'll kind of go back around the horn here to you, Matthew, and see if is there a 2010 game that you're particularly excited about?
I'm really looking forward to Heavy Rain. Mm. Really, really enjoyed Indigo Prophecy. It was incredibly flawed, and, you know, the ending was awful. It totally fell apart, but it had so many kind of fresh and interesting ideas about, you know, diverging storylines and, you know, playing both sides of a story, playing the accused murderer and the people chasing after the murderer, and just it played again those two sides so well that I'm really looking forward to what Heavy Rain does with the, especially with the kind of mundane everyday things. You see scenes from the trailers, you know, just as someone, single dad talking to his kid. I think he just, you know, arrived at the house and trying to make him feel comfortable. I mean, just little things like that, the situations you never get to explore in a video game coming through, even in this kind of the limited way that Indigo Prophecy, Heavy Rain style games seem to do it. I'm looking forward to it very much.
Yeah, I've heard people, or I guess maybe I've read online conversations about like the game trailers that have come out. People are seeing that stuff and they get, oh, sort of, I'm less interested in the game now, or this looks stupid, or whatever. And like, the more mundane that stuff is, the more interested I get in the game. Like, the less it looks like a standard kind of video game, but that, you know, it kind of wants to take its time and give you alternative ways of interacting with human beings around you. Just seems to me to be, they're up to some. I mean, it could either be a, you know, a fabulous success, or maybe a noble failure.
Yeah, I have trouble seeing it being kind of a middle-of-the-road game. And I think even, you know, no matter what form it comes in, it's going to be extremely polarizing in the same way that Indigo Prophecy was, I suspect.
Yeah. Well, this is just me. So, I mean, you know, I don't mean to suggest other people should necessarily think this, but I just wish Cage would stop talking about the game, to be honest. Like, the more he talks about it, the more damage he does. I think he just needs to go back to the studio and do his work and just let it percolate and let us all discover the game. But I get nervous when artists, you know, like talk a lot about what we should expect or what they think we should know about the game before it comes out. I don't know. Makes me nervous.
I had somewhat of a negative reaction because I recently started Indigo Prophecy, bought it on the Steam sale, and him interjecting or putting himself in the introduction to Indigo Prophecy, I was like, what's this?
Yeah. It's like the artist doesn't quite trust his own work enough, you know? At least, and I think he wants to think of himself as an artist. I mean, I'm going to give him that, you know, I'll accept the fact that he wants to function that way.
But I think most game developers or game designers who consider themselves artists also do that stepping in and overstating it. I know Peter Molyneux does it as well.
Well, that's a whole separate podcast subject there, I think. okay, good. What about you, Alex? You got a game you have your eye on?
I think the biggest one's probably Mass Effect 2.
Yeah.
I'm really looking forward to that.
Yeah. Do you expect that most people who played Mass Effect 1, I mean, you can carry over your character, right? So
Yeah. Like Quest for Glory style. I'm so excited.
Yes.
See, I was going to save that to the end, but, you know, I was going to make a sort of public declaration for anyone who happens to listen to this podcast that Dennis and Alex need to team up and do a Quest for Glory series. Like a 10-part, you know, in-depth exploration.
We've discussed it.
You could. You should do it. I'm serious. You should do it.
Yeah.
It's not been, that game has been woefully under... written about.
Seriously?
Yeah. Or that whole series, not just one game. Okay, so good. So Mass Effect 2 for you, Alex. Yes. What about you, Dennis?
I don't know. For me, I'm sort of curious to see what indie games come out. I know I was impressed with both Tale of Tales games released this year.
Yeah.
It's Tale of Tales who did The Path and Salome, correct? Or
right.
Fatal.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, and I don't see them stopping anytime soon, so I'm kind of interested because I know my second game was probably going to be my second choice for this was either Fatal or The Path, and it's those games that I don't see coming that I'm sort of interested in because I had a lot of those experiences, especially with Flash games this year, Today I Die and games like that.
It's interesting too that team because we were just talking about David Cage and the way he talks about his games.
Yeah, they should shut up too.
I think so. But having said that, I mean, they get a little combative occasionally, and I kind of like that in a way that an artist can be kind of garrulous, you know, that they'll sort of defend their turf and what they're up to in ways that I kind of admire. I don't know.
I like it when they generally talk about games as art. I find it less convincing. For instance, I follow them on Facebook, and they recently made a post comparing how the Wii is bringing down video gaming as an art form. And it's like,
I didn't see that.
I think, too, from the indie side, I don't know if they're coming out in 2010, but Dear Jerky Eye has been working on Life Flashes By.
And, oh, yeah.
Pfeiffer, I'm sure I'm butchering both of their names, but is making a game based on the protests in Iran, and I imagine those are both going to be coming out in 2010, so that's something to look forward to.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned Corvus in a previous segment mentioned Deirdre's game as well, so hopefully be able to shine at least a little bit extra light on that project. It's a Kickstarter project, as have other games that have come from the indie scene.
And also Chris Dallin did his Killscreen magazine. Funded that via Kickstarter.
Exactly, yeah.
It's an interesting model.
Yeah, and it's the community seems, I mean, I don't know how long Deirdre's took, but it seemed like it was like quick that she got the funding she asked for. People believed in the project. And, you know, people knew who she was because she is kind of an online presence that I think people wanted to get behind. But I don't know, if I'm a young indie developer looking at ways of getting funded, I'd be incredibly encouraged by that whole process.
Definitely.
Well, I've taken up enough of your time. I want to thank all of you, Alex Raymond, Dennis Farr, and Matt Gallant, for joining me on the Brainy Gamer podcast. It's been a pleasure talking to you, and Happy New Year to all three of you.
Thanks. Happy New Year.
Thank you. Likewise.
Happy New Year, and thanks a lot for having us back, or for the first time. Or just having us.
Yeah, well, it's been great to have Dennis and Alex as first-timers. Hope we can have you back sometime. And Matt, as always, great talking to you.
It was fun.
Great. Take care.
You too. Bye.
I thought for a long time about which game I'd choose as my favorite this year. Demon's Souls grabbed me by the throat, wouldn't let go of me. It's been a long time since a game held my interest for so long. It was the game that I thought about playing when I was busy doing other things, and that always tells you something. But it's not my favorite. Uncharted 2 knocked me out. I love rollicking adventure stories. I love those old 30s action serials that inspired Indiana Jones, that inspired Lara Croft, that inspired Uncharted. I just love that whole lineage. And as we discussed in a couple of the segments, it's just such an expertly crafted game. Beautifully paced, beautifully acted, and just beautiful. Just plain beautiful, period. It's just a really beautiful game. But not quite my favorite. Little King's Story was a sentimental contender for me, flaws and all. Nels describes the game perfectly in the segment that I recorded, so I won't rehash it. But, you know, this game was the biggest surprise for me all year. It was one of those games that you think you'll pop in for a few minutes just to take a quick look and then get back to the game that you're supposed to be playing, and suddenly you're drawn in. And that's what happened to me with Little King's Story. I just didn't see that game coming. It's just such a ambitious little trickster, that game. You'd think you know what's coming, and you don't. But not my favorite. On the DS, the new Mario & Luigi game, the Shin Megami Tensei Devil Survivor game, Clash of Heroes, Retro Game Challenge, a little game called Big Bang Mini, which I loved. All of these games kept me happy all year. It was a good year for the DS, in my opinion. I think some people disagree with that, but for me, it was great. But looking back over my own writing in 2009, one game clearly inspired me more than any other, and that game is Flower. Flower is the game that gave me the deepest and the most pure sense of pleasure as a gamer that I experienced all year, and maybe in many years. So what is it about this game? Flower suspended my analysis mind. It disabled this sort of automatic critical mechanism that switches on when I play games these days. It took me back to a time when that mechanism didn't exist for me. And something about that felt precious to me. I treasured that experience. Flower to me is a game about longing. It's a game about rebirth and redemption. I know that not everyone sees it this way, and I know lots of people think that we artsy types grabbed onto this game like it was some kind of lesson in aesthetics or something, and we saw more than there was to see. But I can tell you that everything I wrote about this game, I meant from the heart. The feeling of oneness with the wind, sensation of flight, this sort of intermingling of freeform play and exploring with a story that unfolds purely without words. The music responding to my movement, feeling of despair that gradually gives way to hope. I love this game. How could I not choose it as my favorite? So, yes, Flower is my favorite game of 2009, and I'm proud to say so. So that brings this epic mini-series of podcasts to an end. It was great fun for me to speak with all my guests. I'm grateful for their time and for their willingness to chat with me. I hope you'll stick with me for more podcasts to come in 2010. Drop by my blog, say hello. Happy New Year to all of you, and happy gaming.